Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. With Donald Trump sending the military to the southern border to help build his wall, we'll begin with President Trump trying to have it both ways, taking credit for the drop in border crossings while ginning up fears of a looming invasion from Mexico. Ivan Eland, a senior fellow and director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independence Institute, who spent 15 years in Congress working on national security issues, joins us to discuss Trump's latest stunt in reaction to criticism from Ann Coulter, which has him shoring up his base by making it seem he is doing something to deliver on his promise to build a wall that Mexico was supposed to pay for. We'll assess how long our reality TV president can keep the press and the public distracted by his daily reality TV stunts to mask the utter incompetence of this dangerous ignoramus who was elected by a minority of Americans. We'll also look into whether reality will catch up with Trump's increasingly frenzied performances, and at what point will his base tire of his antics and realize Trump is a fraud. Because then, presumably, the Republicans in Congress will stop defending him, thus making impeachment both possible and likely. Then we'll speak with Stephen Pfeiffer, the director of the Brookings Institution's Arms Control Initiative and a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine and senior director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. He joins us to discuss outgoing National Security Advisor General McMaster's broadside at the Trump administration, deliberately contradicting Trump's claim that nobody has been tougher on the Russians than Trump has. We will also assess the UN Security Council's meeting today, called by Russia to head off next week's release of a report by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons on their investigation into the use of a nerve agent against a Russian exile on British soil. Then finally, we will speak with a former news director of a TV station that the Sinclair Group took over and forced the local news anchors to mouth must-run pro-Trump propaganda mandated by the owners of Sinclair, the Smith family. Aaron Weiss, who spent 14 years as a local news producer and news director, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, Confessions of a Former Sinclair News Director, and how Sinclair is forcing professional journalists to become state propagandists. And joining us now is Ivan Eland, who is a senior fellow and director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independence Institute. He was previously director of defense policy studies at the Cato Institute and spent 15 years working for Congress on national security issues, including stints as an investigator for the House Foreign Affairs Committee and principal defense analyst at the Congressional Budget Office. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ivan Eland.
Thanks for having me on.
And it seems that President Trump wants it both ways. On the one hand, he wants to take credit for the fact that there's been a substantial reduction in border crossings on the southern border. But at the same time, he's ginning up fears about a caravan of illegal immigrants surging north from Mexico that are threatening the security of the country and require a military response. So how do you see it?
Well, The number of people coming across the border illegally has been reduced, but of course that didn't necessarily start with Trump. I mean, our sluggish economy has prevented a lot of people from thinking this is a good place to come. Now, they haven't, of course, they haven't all thought that this is not a good place to come, because some still do, but there's been a net outflow in other years, and so I think, you know, attributing it to Trump is a little bit much, but I think you're right. He's trying to have it both ways, because he's trying to gin up fear when actually the numbers are down and, in fact, there's a net outflow. So this caravan was also been exaggerated. It's mostly women and children, and most of them want to resettle in Mexico because they're from Honduras. But and those that want to come into the United States are planning on applying for asylum, which is a legal process of getting in. They're not trying to climb over the fence, or at least most of them don't seem to be, but by being interviewed by people. So I think the threat that these people, that this mostly women and children caravan of about 1,100 people is like an invasion force with criminals and terrorists and everything else, is, of course, vastly overstated. And therefore, of course, this military excursion that's going to happen is going to be completely for show to Trump's base rather than because it's really needed to for the security of the country.
So do you think that, in a sense, that you and I are being used by the president even talking about this? Because in many ways, it seems that we have government by stunt, and we have a president who spends most of his working days watching television, and particularly watching Fox News. And he's come under some criticism since he signed the funding bill, and Ann Coulter and others have attacked him. And my sense is that that's what he's responding to. I mean, he goes off and says he's going to have tariffs against China, and then the next day they back away from that. It just feels like we're all being manipulated. How does it strike you?
Well, we're being manipulated, which I think you're right is the case. It's not being done very competently. I think this thing was triggered by two things. He saw this caravan being commented on in his favorite show on Fox, Fox and Friends. And then the second thing is exactly what you're saying. The conservative got on him about the spending in the budget bill, but not getting spending for his wall. So he, and I think he needs his base. I think he's getting a little scared of the Russia investigation. And really, his base, once his base goes against him, then the Republicans in the House and Senate won't support him anymore. And therefore, if they do try to impeach him at some point, he wouldn't have his base. So I think, he needs to keep his base, and Ann Coulter is a sign that the base might be eroding a bit because a lot of these people voted for him because they were fearful of immigration, that sort of thing. And I think probably excessively so, given the actual threat from it. And I think he has stoked these fears, and he's got to keep stoking them to keep the base happy.
So do you have any historical precedents you could think of about a president using our military as a kind of prop, if that's what it comes down to, that sending the...
Oh, well, there's a lot of them, actually. But the military has been used for a lot of political reasons by other presidents. In this case, I think the precedent was set by George W. Bush and Obama. They sent troops down to the border. They mainly were in a support role because that's what they have to be. They would violate a posse comitatus law, which is a law from the 1878, which basically the fancy name for it is just another way of saying the military can't be involved in law enforcement. But there's some exceptions to that. But they don't really apply in this case. So I think the military would have to be, if he sends them down there, they're probably going to have to be in an intelligence gathering mode, maybe do some wall, some fence construction. He didn't get the money for the wall, so they're going to be repairing fence and that sort of thing. I mean, they could have a limited role, which is what they did under George W. Bush and Obama. But I don't see them actively enforcing the border simply because that's against the law. Now, if he did that, then I think you'd have severe pushback from Congress and popular pushback as well.
And again, I'm speaking with Ivan Eland, who is a senior fellow and director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independence Institute. He has been a director of defense policy studies at the Cato Institute and spent 15 years working for Congress on national security issues, including stints as an investigator for the House Foreign Affairs Committee and principal defense analyst at the Congressional Budget Office. So when you mentioned the military might be sort of repairing holes in the border fence between the U.S. and Mexico, today, at a discussion on tax policy in West Virginia, the president said, we have to have strong borders. We are going to have the wall. We're already started building it. We have $1.6 billion. We are building it and fixing miles and miles of wall that's already up and fence. We're going to have our wall. We're going to get it very strongly. The military is going to be building some of it. So that's the president's remarks today. How does that work? The military wouldn't be armed, would they? I mean, in other words, if they're building the fence and a bunch of immigrants rush through a hole in the fence, what would the military do?
Well, I think they would probably alert the Border Patrol. They might be carrying pistols to defend themselves. If somebody attacked them, they might be able to defend themselves. That's usually the rules of engagement in these types of things. But they shouldn't be apprehending. They're not supposed to arrest people, and they're not supposed to even process people who are being arrested. They're supposed to gather intelligence through, you know, through air monitoring or ground surveillance, and also, you know, they can help build the repair the fence. Now, when Trump says he makes it seem like Congress gave him some money for his wall, but they didn't. In fact, they specifically said this is not money for the wall and don't build it. This is repairing fence that already exists. There's fence along some of the border areas already, and this is not an impregnable wall. This is merely repairing money for repairing the fence that already exists.
Well, the other thing that he said today at this tax policy roundtable in West Virginia was, and remember my opening remarks at Trump Tower when I opened, everybody said, oh, he was so tough, and I used the word rape. And yesterday it came out that this journey coming up, women are raped at levels that nobody has ever seen before. They don't want to mention it, so we have to change our laws. What is he talking about? Do you have any idea?
Well, I think he's alluding to the myth in Europe that that all the immigrants from the Middle East were raping women. And I think he's sort of transferring that over here and implying that a lot of these people coming across from Mexico or through Mexico from Honduras and other Central American countries are raping women. And, you know, that's just preposterous. It's just a way to instill fear. And that's what his entire campaign was based on, fear and on immigration. And he continues to do that.
So what's your sense then of where we stand on, I mean, obviously there was a comprehensive immigration plan that was stalled during the George W. Bush administration. And ever since then, it's been a political football. Is there any sense that this will go beyond political scapegoating, which is, I think, a shorthand way of describing what's happening now?
Yeah, this is an election year, and I don't think they're going to do anything. The Democrats and even some Republicans, a bipartisan group of people, proposed after that White House meeting where he sort of agreed to do something on DACA. They, proposed some arrangement to safeguard the DACA kids in return for giving him all the $25 billion he wanted for his border wall. But he turned it down after implying that he would takes some sort of an agreement. So I don't think he wants it. And now I don't think the Democrats want it, because I think he's so bad on immigration that that's one more group in addition to suburban, you know, housewives and young people that are not too happy with him. And so I think the Democrats are content to run on the fact that he's anti-immigrant and, they're pro-immigrant.
Well, that $25 billion offer from Schumer and Pelosi definitely alarmed a lot of Democrats. I don't know what kind of pushback they got personally, but the thing that you've worked for the Cato Institute, which is a libertarian-minded think tank. Wouldn't spending $25 billion on this wall be one of the most flagrant example of pork barrel waste of money? I mean, it seems to me the stupidest thing imaginable, because it's environmentally catastrophic. It doesn't work. It's unnecessary. It's just, I mean, I think it would, if it ever was built, it would be an embarrassment to this country.
Yeah, well, I think, it's a reminder of the Berlin Wall, which nobody really liked in the West. So I think, yes, it is a colossal waste of money. In fact, a lot of immigrants, illegal immigrants, simply overstay their legal visas after they're done. And, you know, they drift into the countryside. And so a wall is not going to help them there. And also, if you build any sort of barrier like that, people are going to find ways around it. Now, it may stem some people from coming in. But, of course, that leads to the larger question, should we really be tightening down immigration? Immigration has built the country, and that's what's made us strong. Different types of people with different types of ideas mixing, and that really creates innovation. Immigration has been a strength. And also, of course, we have the niggling problem of the Social Security pension system. And the one thing that's keeping our country young, both for the workforce and for to support that pension system, are immigrants from other countries. Other countries like China, Italy, Russia, Germany, they have aging populations. And we have an aging population, but it isn't quite as bad because of immigrants. So there's a lot of benefits to immigrants. And I think the wall is a colossal waste of money. I think the Democrats, that probably did alarm the liberal base, but I think they were trying to just say, okay, well, give them a symbolic victory on this wall. It's a waste of $25 billion, but at least we'll get something for the DACA kids. And I'm not really sure that it was really worth it if they would have gotten it, but it was a potential settlement of the whole matter, at least, well, not the whole matter, but at least an immigration compromise, but Trump turned it down. So I think he would rather have the issue for the elections than rather than solving the problem. And I think the reason he wants the issue is to shore up his base because he thinks he might be getting in trouble on the Russia investigation.
Well, it's, the Democratic deal was, we'll give you the $25 billion if you allow the DACA kids a path to citizenship. And now, of course, first of all, it was the Trump administration that killed DACA, and now he's saying DACA is dead. So you've got, 800,000 kids in limbo? What kind of a political football is that? And how does that play in the election? Do we have any polling on that, whether there are enough Americans that... He himself, by the way, has said, Trump, on many occasions, he said that he wants to do something beautiful for these wonderful kids.
Right, and I think a lot of Republicans support that. Overwhelmingly, the polls show that even a lot of Republicans support doing something for the DACA kids because it wasn't their fault that they were brought here illegally. Their parents came illegally, and they were small children. And it's only a limited number of people that qualify for this. He makes it seem like, their people are still trying to take advantage of this program, and you can't do it. And I think, he did pull the rug out from under this program. And, technically it was very questionable that Obama did this by executive order when the Congress wouldn't do it. But on the other hand, if he's going to pull the executive order and put it on a more constitutional basis by having Congress now controlled by Republicans and he's a Republican, if you want to solve the problem, then go ahead and put it on more constitutional footing by passing a law. But then, of course, he backed away from that. So, yes, he did cause the problem in the first place. And, he doesn't really want to solve it.
Well, just in closing, Ivan Edelman, have you ever seen anything like this? Government by stunt is the way I describe it, where we basically have a reality TV star using the White House as a sort of platform for all of these peculiar antics. And he's only focuses on himself, it would seem, and not on the country. And there's a certain level of desperation in what he's doing, it would seem. I don't think he knows how to do the job. And the country seems to be just going to hell in a handbasket. And, there's not much of an opposition. They talk about a blue wave, but the Democrats aren't really – they're sort of waiting around for this guy to collapse under his own weight. It just feels like there's no real leadership in this country anymore, and least of all the Republicans in the House and Senate seem to have no moral compass.
Well, I think that latter statement is very true. They're certainly not pushing back against Trump at all. And I think, other presidents have manipulated fear and war and fear of immigrants, et cetera, fear of race in the past. But I think Trump has done it the most. And I think you're right. He's a reality star. He's not a president. He's incompetent at the job. And that's really the only thing he knows is reality TV. And unfortunately, the press, most of the press, even what he would call the fake news, goes along with covering his antics because it's ratings gold. I mean, I think all the news stations' ratings are up since he became president. Remember, the debates were up because everybody wants to tune in to see what he's going to call somebody a new nickname or, what type of odd behavior he's going to exhibit. So I think yes, it's government by sensationalism and stunt. And I think that's a good way to put it, really, because we've never seen another president do this. And I think eventually, you know, demagogues always fall by the wayside, such as Joseph McCarthy, who ran the anti-communist hearings in the 1950s. He eventually went too far, and people, when he started attacking the army, and people said, hey, you know, this has gone too far. And I think Trump is going to do something. I'm not sure what it will be, but I think eventually people will become as exhausted and tired of him.
Well, Ivan Eland, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Ivan Eland, who's a senior fellow and director of the Center on Peace and Liberty at the Independence Institute. He was previously director of defense policy studies at the Cato Institute, and he spent 15 years working for Congress on national security issues, including stints as an investigator for the House Foreign Affairs Committee and principal defense analyst at the Congressional Budget Office. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back discussing outgoing National Security Advisor General McMaster's broadside at the Trump administration.
Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation. Television.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Stephen Pfeiffer, who is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russia issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Pfeiffer.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you, Stephen. And having been on the National Security Council yourself, what did you think of the farewell broadside by General McMaster, who's been fired to be replaced by John Bolton on April the 9th? He made a speech before the Atlantic Council in which he said some nations have looked the other way in the face of threats from Russia. Russia brazenly and implausibly denies its actions, and we have failed to impose sufficient costs. Now, what was extraordinary was that Sarah Sanders, the White House spokesperson, when asked a question by a reporter of what is their response, the White House's response to General McMaster's remarks, critical of the passivity of the Trump administration, Sanders turned around and said, no, that's not what McMaster said. He said that nobody's been tougher on the Russians than Donald Trump, which is a complete lie. I mean, it seems like the White House has now become like some third world farce, like Saddam Hussein's Baghdad Bob's extraordinary press conferences. So I guess that's a separate issue, but I was astounded by that. Perhaps I'm naive, but let's talk about McMaster's remarks. How did they strike you?
Well, I think General McMaster was correct, is that we have not imposed sufficient penalties on Russia for what was a hugely egregious action by the Russians, their attempt to affect the 2016 presidential election. And my concern is that since we have not imposed real cost on the Kremlin sees no reason why it should not try it again in the 2018 elections or the 2020 elections. Now, I guess on the question of has the Trump administration been tough on Russia, it's kind of an interesting appearance. I think you have actually seen steps over the last year and a half, such as the expulsion of Russian diplomats, such as the decision to provide lethal military assistance to Ukraine, something the Obama administration would not do, that in a way are tougher. I mean, there's been sort of a continuation of and a toughening of the Obama policy towards Russia, at least the Obama policy of the last couple of years of its term. But I think these are policies that are carried out by the administration that I'm not sure the president himself believes in. I mean, certainly when the president talks about Russia or he talks about Vladimir Putin, he doesn't criticize Putin. He keeps talking about wanting a better relationship with Russia, which I would like to see, but it's very difficult to see how you get to a better relationship with Russia if Russia is not prepared to correct some of its misbehavior.
Well, there are a couple of fronts, though, where Donald Trump's behavior borders on raising suspicions of, I guess treason is a pretty harsh word, but raises the question of who is our president? Who is he working for? Because, for example, the 2,000 U.S. soldiers that are in Syria now occupy the oil fields that are valuable to Assad. They sit astride what would be a land corridor between Tehran and Damascus. And Trump wants to pull them out. And the military is saying, no, you can't do that. First of all, we haven't finished off the Islamic State, and they'll just come back. And then on top of that, the Kurds will be slaughtered by the Turks, Assad, the Iranians, and the Russians. And frankly, you'd be handing over Syria to Russia. So that's one issue that raises real questions in my mind. And the other one is when his own National Security Council told him not to congratulate Putin, he went ahead and congratulated him. And then we learned from the Russians that Trump invited Putin to the White House at the time when the 26 nations were ostracizing him for the nerve agent attack on British soil.
Now, I think if you are an American analyst sitting in Moscow right now, trying to figure out U.S. policy is probably pretty difficult because the president keeps sending very different signals which differ radically from the message that his administration tries to communicate. I mean, on a summit idea, quite frankly, a summit between Presidents Trump and Putin could be useful if, there are two big ifs, if the summit is well prepared and President Trump is well prepared, and if President Trump is prepared to confront Putin on where Russia has carried out transgressions, its aggression against Ukraine, its interference in the U.S. election, the poisoning of the former Russian spy in Britain. And I don't think the president is prepared to do those sorts of things. That's where a summit then can be a little bit dangerous, because you got to know that Vladimir Putin would come to that meeting very well prepared.
And again, I'm speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, who is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine and Russia issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine and Eurasia on the National Security Council. So today at the United Nations Security Council, Russia called a meeting where its ambassador spoke for about an hour with extremely skillful propaganda, which, frankly, the Russians are really good at that. And it made it all seem like the poisoning of the Russian double agent in the English country town of Salisbury was all done by the Brits. Why the Brits would use a Russian nerve agent against these Russians, father and daughter, along with British first responders, is pretty mind-boggling. But that's basically the case that Vasily Nebenzia put forth to the UN today. He asserted with a high degree of probability the intelligence services of other countries are behind the March 4th poisoning of the former double agent Sergei Skripal and his daughter, quoting the Russian ambassador to the Security Council. This is a coordinated, very well-planned campaign aiming to undermine Russia's role, not only in finding a solution in Syria, but anywhere else. So what's going on here? I mean, this is clearly designed to muddy the waters ahead of next week's release of the report by the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the watchdog group based in The Hague, that rejected Moscow's bid to join in the investigation. Clearly, the Russians are worried about that. But do you think that anybody's, I mean, apart from the few loony leftists who send letters to me, I can't see anybody's going to believe this.
It was a Russian-produced nerve agent. The Russian security services, the successors to the KGB, they take a very dim view of traitors, and in their mind, Skripal was a traitor. And you have a history of mysterious deaths of Russian emigres, Russians who've gone to Britain. The Litvinenko poisoning with polonium back 10, 12 years ago. So I think the clearest evidence points to a Russian hand in this. What you see Moscow doing, though, is throwing out all kinds of theories. There was one theory advanced by their ambassador at the United Nations today about Britain being responsible. But over the last 2 weeks, they've said, well, this nerve agent could have been produced in the United States. It could have been produced in Sweden. It could have been produced in the Czech Republic. And this has become, I think, really the typical Russian response to these kinds of charges, is not to present a credible alternative, but to throw out lots of ideas in the hopes of creating so much smoke and mirrors that people just begin to doubt all versions, very much like we saw in the aftermath of the shootdown by Russian-supported proxy forces in Ukraine of the Malaysian airliner back in 2014.
Well, there's certainly a deja vu quality to that. I was about to bring that up, as a matter of fact. But in general, what is the way out of this situation? My sense is that, and I've heard this from a number of Russians, that Putin, ironically, is a victim of his own success with the Russian people. They think he's a genius and that he pulled off the greatest piece of intelligence tradecraft in history by installing Donald Trump in the White House. Therefore, the average Russian feels they don't have anything to worry about the Americans anymore. They don't feel threatened by them because we own their president. So is that what's going on here, that they picked on the Brits because they were just low-hanging fruit, because Putin needed to do something to rile up his people to get him to vote for him in this bogus election that he just took place?
Well, I partially agree and partially disagree. I mean, it seems to me that one of the problems we have in dealing with Russia right now is Russia believes that it can violate the rules. It can use military force to take territory from Ukraine with its seizure of Crimea and its involvement in Donbass, you know, with the idea of going, it can assassinate Russians on the territory of sovereign nations, and it doesn't believe that there are serious consequences to these actions. And I would very much like to see us get back to a better relationship with Russia, but it seems to me that the path to getting there is beginning to impose costs on the Russians for this kind of behavior, and then the Russians may well adjust and begin to come back into and play by the rules. And then discussions may be a lot more productive in trying to get out of this low point we are. But, you know, there's, I think, a fairly strong signal that in the West there's a wide view that Russia has basically gone beyond the pale. The striking thing to me about the expulsion of the Russian diplomats that took place early last week was you had almost 30 countries. You've never seen that kind of action, but 30 countries expelling Russian diplomats based on evidence which we have not seen publicly, but evidence that Britain has shared with their European partners in other countries. And I think that probably surprised the Russians. Now, the Russians responded as they typically do with expulsions, is they expelled diplomats in return. But my guess is in the Kremlin, it was a bit of a shock to see that much of Europe and other countries line up with Britain in saying this is not acceptable behavior. The question is, can we now find a way to press Moscow to change its behavior?
Well, do you think that these sanctions that are supposed to be announced next Tuesday against Russia, supposedly against some oligarchs, are they going to have any teeth?
We'll have to see. I mean, the expulsions were a very useful political symbol, but we also, I mean, I'm sure that in the U.S. government, when they did those expulsions, they fully understood that the Russians would retaliate with counter-expulsions. So that's a useful signal, but what the Kremlin fears more are steps that begin to get at people close to the Kremlin personally, and also steps that can have an impact on the Russian economy. And if there are now serious economic sanctions, asset seizures, for example, in addition to visa bans, that begin targeting people close to the Kremlin, I'm not sure you have a group there that can overrule Putin, but they're going to have a concern that the Kremlin will pay some attention to. And that would be the kind of message that it would be difficult for the Kremlin to respond to, because there simply is no analog in terms of Americans who want to bring a lot of money into Russia.
Well, there is a lot of Europeans that are hooked on Gazprom, too. I don't know whether there's anything that can be done there, or naming and shaming all the money that Putin's had abroad.
Well, we Yeah, but it's a fair point. But I think we also have to understand, it's easier for Americans to talk about economic sanctions on Russia than for Europe, because prior to 2014, the economic relationship, the trade between Europe and Russia was about 10 times the trade between the United States and Russia. So economic sanctions have an impact on Europe more so than on the United States. But if you look over the last 4 years, actually the European Union has hung in there with some fairly tight sanctions. And I think even in the case of the gas, while they are dependent on, or that they get a large portion of their natural gas from Russia, I believe over the last 8 or 9 years you've seen also a number of European companies build facilities to receive liquefied natural gas so that if they ever got into a gas crisis with Russia, they have an alternative. And that's got to make Gazprom a little bit nervous.
But just in closing, it would seem, though, that Russia's investment in its economy and its future is entirely at odds with global warming. In other words, their whole economic plan for the future is to sell more oil and sell more gas and just about nothing else.
I would argue that that's not a winning strategy for Russia. First of all, some of the sanctions that are being applied will deny Western technology and Western capital for future gas and oil field developments in Russia. So as they deplete existing fields, it's going to be harder and more costly for them to bring new fields online. But also, as long as Russia continues to be so dependent on energy exports, you know, it's not developing an economy that makes things. I mean, other than weapons, Russia doesn't build things that the world wants to buy. And I think as long as they continue to have an economy whose export structure is 70% oil, gas, gold, and timber, you know, it's going to be an economy that's going to have a hard time competing in the 21st century. And Mr. Putin doesn't seem to get that. And I think that's likely to lead to a weakening of the Russian state over the next 10 or 15, 20 years.
Well, Stephen Pfeiffer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, who is a non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russia issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back speaking with a former news director of a TV station that the Sinclair Group took over and forced the local news anchors to mouth must-run pro-Trump propaganda. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Aaron Weiss, who spent 14 years as a local news producer, executive producer, and news director. He now works at the nonprofit Center for Western Priorities, where he hosts their podcast, Go West Young Podcast. And he has an op-ed at the Huffington Post, Confessions of a Former Sinclair News Director. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aaron Weiss.
Thank you, Ian. Great to be here.
So, Aaron, already there's some pushback coming from Democratic candidates running in the elections this year to pull their ads from Sinclair. I noticed when Rupert Murdoch was in a competitive bid for Tribune, which Sinclair is about to close a deal on, Murdoch said that he was still interested in buying stations, local stations in the swing states, because you make so much money out of TV advertising. So let's start with that question in the context of what we've learned about Cambridge Analytica and how Trump may well have won the election by using some of these internet tools and Facebook. How significant is it, television advertising for political candidates?
TV as a business right now, it's become a cyclical business where revenue, particularly in swing states, goes way up in election years and drops off in non-years. There is so much money in politics and in campaigns that there's in a busy state in, say, where I worked in Sioux City, Iowa, there's no inventory by the end of an election year as you're leading up. It's just all political ads all the time. So if you run a TV station or a group of TV stations, the markets that you have in places like Iowa, Florida, Ohio, they do become exceptionally valuable in election years.
So given that Sinclair famously forced their stations to run a anti-John Kerry documentary just before the Democratic nominee lost in the 2004 presidential election, what do you expect from Sinclair if they get the Tribune deal, which I think is a foregone conclusion, and therefore have stations in the really big markets here in Los Angeles, New York, Chicago, Denver, etc.? What do you expect?
Well, I think it'll be interesting to see with the attention that they're getting now that they haven't really gotten in the past, certainly haven't gotten since making the stations run that Swift Boat documentary in 2004, whether there's that same level of attention on what they're doing leading up to, say, midterms this fall. If there's more of that corporate content that is, you know, clearly national corporate level content, will it have the same sort of, you know, obvious political bent getting close to the election? And what, if anything, will folks do about that? I think we've seen so far Sinclair really just doesn't care too much about all of this criticism. I was just looking online, and Circa, which is their online news operation that they bought and have transformed into a pretty conservative news outlet, is right now doing a live Facebook chat with Boris Epstein, the former Trump advisor. So they're happy with their content and doubling down on it. Whether public pressure could make them change, I just don't know.
Well, I guess the only Achilles heel that they have, at least theoretically, I think, is that people like you and other news professionals simply won't be able to stomach being turned into propagandists. I used to work on arms control issues during the Cold War and spent a lot of time in Russia and would meet with lots of Russian journalists from TASS and Pravda. And you knew that a lot of them were KGB people, but you knew that you kind of felt sorry for them because they had to basically toe the party line and just broadcast what the government told them to broadcast. And it seems so un-American to have a kind of Ministry of Truth or a Pravda for the Republican Party, as both Fox and Sinclair are. So what's your reading on that? In other words, if there's a lot of protest and people like you pushing back within the organization, will they simply just fire those people and get a bunch of willing propagandists? Or could pressure from the inside change the minds of the Smith family?
Could pressure from the inside change the Smith family? No, I don't think so. The more interesting question is, at what point does Sinclair really have a serious recruiting problem? Because it is, if you're a journalist and you're looking for a job and you have the option between a Sinclair station and a non-Sinclair station, unless you're on board with the political agenda or you, for some reason, really don't care, it becomes hard to take a job at Sinclair. And they do have a reputation in the industry, of course, and now nationwide for this political agenda. And I saw a stat yesterday on journalismjobs.com, which is the big recruiting board for journalism jobs. 63% of the listings right now are at Sinclair stations. Now, some of that is a reflection of the size of Sinclair, but not that much. Sinclair doesn't control 63% of the jobs across the entire industry. So that, to me, is a sign that they're having recruiting problems already. And we know that they hang on to talent they do have. If you're under contract with Sinclair and you try to leave early, they threaten to take you to court. I heard from former employees of mine. I've seen stories from a reporter at NBC Los Angeles who used to be with Sinclair. And their contracts have very clear liquid damages spelled out that are into the five digits if you try to leave a contract early. And these are folks in a small market who are making $25,000, $30,000, $35,000 a year. And Sinclair takes those contracts seriously.
And again, I'm speaking with Aaron Weiss, who spent 14 years as a local news producer, executive producer, and news director. He now works for the nonprofit Center for Western Priorities, where he hosts their podcast, Go West Young Podcast. And he has an op-ed at the Huffington Post, Confessions of a Former Sinclair News Director. Well, given that Sinclair, in a very cynical and clever use of propaganda, have bought these stations so that they can use the credibility of the local news anchors who've built up their following in the community over decades and literally put their editorial must-run propaganda in the mouths of these anchors. Will there be a defection from anchors or pushback from anchors? If they've got local credibility and got some clout, presumably, first of all, in the local news market, anchors change stations all the time. Here in Los Angeles, one minute you've got the lead anchor on it, NBC, and the next day they're on CBS.
So, number one, it's actually pretty hard to switch stations within a market, particularly if you don't have a good agent. In most states and most markets, non-compete clauses are standard, so that if you want to go across the street to another station, you generally have to sit out off the air for 6 months. And in my 14 years as a broadcast journalist, I can only think of a single case where a station was willing to hire someone from across the street and pay them to sit out their non-compete for 6 months. It rarely happens. So it is actually very hard to stay in your market but go across the street to another station. That said, we've already seen some anchors standing up and saying either I was embarrassed by that and you deserve better because of my credibility. And even this morning saw an anchor in Eugene, Oregon, which I was surprised at. It's a very small market. And one of the anchors said, no, I didn't tape that and I refused to. That's the first case I'm aware of that. Now, that station, KVAL, had another of their anchors end up taping that promo that we've seen everywhere thanks to Deadspin. So it may just be that that station didn't put their foot down, or it may be that corporate didn't know that an anchor refused and, you know, in that case didn't care because it's a pretty small market. I'm not sure what the case is in that particular case.
Well, the Deadspin video that you referred to was pretty damning, where they just literally showed lots and lots of these anchors reciting the same piece of copy. And it just spoke for itself. And so I imagine a lot of those people on screen there in that mosaic that Deadspin put out, they've got to feel a little embarrassed, don't you think?
Oh, I'm sure. My heart went out to all of them, both as someone who used to be a news manager and as someone who grew up in the business. My mom was an anchor in Tucson for 30 years, so I put myself in their shoes, or in the shoes of if that had been my mom 30 years ago with a 6-year-old, 7-year-old kid at home having to make the decision, do I read this even though it goes against every fiber of my being as a journalist, or do I take a stand and risk losing my job or get out of the business or whatever other options you have? I certainly can't blame anyone for making the choice to read the promo, and I think that was obvious when you see it. You know, a lot of them had the sincerity of a proof of life hostage video.
Well, it is really, again, I see it as being completely un-American, and I don't understand why conservatives in this country, you know, first of all, I don't understand why they're not concerned about Vladimir Putin and his activities against us, but it seems to be in that same mindset that we become so tribal and polarized in our politics that conservatives have forgotten what conservatism is about and are acting more like Soviet vassals, almost fellow travelers. It's embarrassing.
I think there is certainly a lot of that when you look at the reaction of folks who either look at that video and see the clear Trumpian dog whistle in the writing. I guess dog whistle is probably too subtle. It was more like a cannonball in terms of the way that was written, borrowing Trump talking points. Some folks claim to have not been bothered by that, which stunned me a little bit, just because to me, as someone on the outside, it was incredibly obvious. And it was, of course, then confirmed by President Trump himself, who tweeted his support for Sinclair, which, again, is not surprising. They had a comfortable, friendly arrangement to make sure that Sinclair stations were getting access to the Trump campaign in the lead up to the election.
Well, I don't imagine the FCC is going to intervene, given the nature of Ajit Pai and how he seems to be a complete corporate lackey, and he's done the bidding of the big telecoms in getting rid of net neutrality. Do you expect anything else but approval of the merger with Sinclair and Tribune?
The only way I could see something derailing it is if the Inspector General investigation that is going on right now into Ajit Pai's dealings turns up something nefarious. And if that's the case, then it's possible maybe he would be sufficiently embarrassed into denying the merger, or I guess in the worst, best case scenario, forced out of the job entirely. But I think those scenarios are pretty unlikely. If I was wagering, setting a line on it, I'd say 80 to 90% chance that the Tribune acquisition goes through.
And if Ajit Pai were to remove himself or be removed, Trump would appoint somebody similar, wouldn't he?
Yeah, that's correct. And I don't know what would happen at that point with the merger, if it would go through with a new rubber stamp or if it would take some amount of time to get someone confirmed again. I haven't really looked through those scenarios, what would happen. Again, I think they're pretty unlikely.
So just to the puzzlement that I have about this whole use of propaganda posing as news, how it strikes me as being deeply un-American. Am I being naive? I mean, I know in the past we've had demagogues like Father Coughlin on television, or he was on radio, of course, before television. But I've never thought that we had overt propagandists before. I mean, not there may well be a kind of, blurring of the lines between demagogues and propaganda. But still, again, back to the idea that there's no tradition in this country to have a ministry of truth in the Orwellian sense. And this is what Fox has become, and what Sinclair even maybe even be more aggressive in that regard. Do you think there's any way to call them out in the spirit of them being un-American?
Well, it certainly doesn't go with 20th century journalistic tradition in America, which does respect a free and independent press overall. I think in some ways it's going back further, going back to 18th and 19th century America, when you didn't have this notion of truly unbiased journalism, and anything out there was fair game. And you look at the stuff that Alexander Hamilton and his buddies would write in the papers under pseudonyms attacking each other. And it's almost taking the Fourth Estate back to that era. And whether that's good for a democracy or not, I'd say it's not, and that a fair and unbiased and accountable press was overall a great thing for America in the 20th century. Is that gone entirely? I don't think so, but certainly Sinclair is a throwback to a much earlier time in terms of what journalism was and looked like.
Well, they did have, going back to Father Coughlin and Colonel McCormick, who was viciously attacking FDR, FDR brought in the Fairness Doctrine, which seemed to be an elegantly simple way to restrain the kind of heated political speech that we've become used to lately. And that meant that if you were a Rupert Murdoch or a member of the Smith family, and you wanted to use your media assets as a private soapbox to propagate and enforce your political views upon the public, you had to offer equal time to an opposing point of view. and that seemed to had restrained the whole thing until in 1987 Ronald Reagan got rid of the Fairness Doctrine.
Yep.
So how significant do you think is that? Because my sense is that ever since the Fairness Doctrine went out of the window, it's not just changed the media, it's changed the politics in this country. They've become much more tribal, much more polarized. Republicans and Democrats used to be friends in the Senate and the House. They used to have dinners together and take vacations together with their families. Now they barely speak to each other.
So here's the thing with the Fairness Doctrine. Is the Fairness Doctrine only ever applied to broadcasting? It never applied to cable, so you can't blame the Fairness Doctrine for the rise of Fox News. It certainly never applied to the internet, because the internet wasn't a thing that the public used before the Fairness Doctrine went away. So the Fairness Doctrine would have never applied to a Breitbart, much less a Stormfront or any of these other racist sites. So then you have the question, all right, what would a Fairness Doctrine look like as applied to cable or look like as applied to the internet? And I can't come up with any way that you could write a Fairness Doctrine that would then also pass First Amendment muster. And I think because of that, and because that's where so many more Americans get their news any today, even if you brought back the Fairness Doctrine for broadcasting, you'd probably have a trouble with that in the courts because there are so many other outlets now. So, I mean, yes, you can point to the Fairness Doctrine as part of the problem. Certainly you can point to gerrymandering as part of the other problem in terms of what's made America more tribal and the fact that members of Congress have gotten much more polarized. Is there a solution there? I guess I'd point to the solution more as how do you draw the lines and make sure elections are more competitive and there aren't as many safe districts. I just don't see a First Amendment compatible solution that brings the internet and cable and broadcast, brings the level of discourse back up, but still passes First Amendment muster. I don't know how you do it.
Well, just in closing, Aaron Weiss, back to, you mentioned the 20th century journalistic tradition of non-biased reporting and neutrality, if you will. That actually, my understanding is that that was brought about by the owners of the newspapers, who basically figured half of our readers are Democrats and half of them are Republicans. And if we slant in one direction, we're going to alienate half of our readers. Therefore, we go right down the middle. Is that behind that tradition? And if so, are Sinclair going to stick their neck out and lose half of their listeners? I mean, here in Los Angeles, I guarantee you, a lot of people aren't going to like Boris Epstein's propaganda.
Oh, sure. I mean, you look at, you know, Sinclair in markets like Portland, Oregon and Seattle, Washington. We know that the phones at Como and K2 at the stations up there light up, that it's wildly unpopular with obviously at least the urban audiences there. I get the sense that Sinclair at the corporate level just doesn't care, that they're making a decision based on their politics and not based on good business. And that's your right as a business owner, I guess. No one forces you to make a good business decision. But I don't think they're making those decisions with business in mind.
Well, Aaron Weiss, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Aaron Weiss, who spent 14 years as a local news producer, executive producer, and news director. He now works at the nonprofit Center for Western Priorities, where he hosts their podcast, Go West Young Podcast. And he has an op-ed at the Huffington Post, Confessions of a Former Sinclair News Director. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Gray Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.